podcast with Dan and Scott. Hottest golf podcast, whether you like it or not. First one back in the day when that's a put at the park. 7 p.m. special where they played after dark. From the birds to the focus to the losses and the win. Welcome podcast, patron to the show, lead the pen. Get busy golfing or get busy dying. Hottest golf podcast and I swear I ain't lying. Yeah. Leave the pen.
Welcome back, podcast patrons. Another episode of Leave the Pen podcast. As always, I'm your host, Dan. This is episode 218. I have an extremely special guest to me, as well as the rest of the golfing community, Mr. Jimmy James, the top 100 golf nomad. This individual played the top 100 golf courses on Golf Digest list in an entire calendar year. So we'll break down the logistics. We'll break down his travel, how difficult it was to get on some of them. And you know some of the ones that I'm talking about out there before we even get into it. And then we're going to preview his new book that's coming out in June. Jimmy, how are you doing, my man?
Hey, Dan. Great to be on with you. Thanks for having me on today. Doing great. Looking forward to telling my story, talking about what's dear to all golfers, of course, being able to get out, tee it up, not only with friends, but on great golf courses.
Awesome. And you and I go back a ways, and I want to sincerely, now that we have kind of our first face-to-face meeting, you sent both my boys an autographed copy of the Golf Digest magazine that you were in. You wrote a nice little foreword to each of them. We still have those. They're in the hutch in our what we call our quiet room, which is kind of like our reading room. And honestly, you know, from someone that didn't know you and from someone that didn't know me, I thought it was such an endearing endeavor that you went out of your way to do that. And I can't thank you enough. So I just want to personally thank you face to face for doing that for both my boys.
Well, I appreciate it. And it's been great to follow them on golf and how they've matured in golf and their success in golf. But I'll also tell you that my whole life is filled with just kind acts from strangers. And it's part of what my mother instilled in each of her eight children. And so I just marvel too at some of the kindness that has been shown me, not only during my golf quest, which we're talking about, but also growing up during my career, just across the entire span of my life. So I was happy to do that. It was flattering to be asked, so I was very happy to do it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. So I've read, and I know you've used this quote before, Steve Martin quote, if I'm incorrect, you know, correct me. He says, I grew up a poor black child. And quite honestly, that's a life that you kind of live. So I wonder if you can get into that growing up in Texas. You know, you talked about growing up on dirt floors. This is a upbringing that not many people in the golf world are familiar with. So I guess in a kind of quick roundabout tour, can you go from how you grew up in that way to kind of where you are at the start of this journey?
So I grew up in the deepest of the piney woods of East Texas, in the Jim Crow era, the late Jim Crow era, there in Texas, Jim Crow, Texas. And Texas is not as deep south, say, as some of the other places might be, but the laws were still in place, still carried out. And so we had the two issues to confront when I was a kid. And that was poverty. Basically, if we didn't grow it, raise it, trap it, or shoot it, we didn't eat it. And at the same time, we're dealing with sort of a second-class citizenship type of environment. The racism that comes along with that. You mentioned in the introduction, the book. And in the book, I actually go into some of the examples of the racism we faced as kids. So there was adversity. But at the time, it was unfortunately just the way the world was. So I try to keep within me that spirit of that little six-year-old kid that I was, who used to play baseball with a stick and a doll's head in the dirt roads that ran between our shacks. So if you can imagine that kid, you know, I'm sure the pros, when they drive down Magnolia Lane to play the Masters, they are in awe. Mm-hmm. That is just a magical feeling. So if you can imagine a six-year-old kid who used to play, run down the dirt roads barefooted with a stick, whacking a doll's head, riding down Magnolia Lane, and the awe and the splendor that invades you, that's what I experience.
I'm sure the feeling's otherworldly.
It is. It's a chasm that's almost too vast to really fathom.
Sure.
So for me, it was like having grown up in a world that lacked almost everything. There I was, entering a world that lacked almost nothing. And of course, as you mentioned and asked, you know, to where I am now, or where I was at the beginning of that moment where I'm playing my first course, Augusta National. Of course, I've endured and overcome the challenges of poverty, of racism, of being living in the projects, seeing drug deals and people shot, and going to school, struggling through stereotypes of who I should be because I live in government housing versus what I'm actually capable of. All of those things to start get to college, first in my family to graduate from high school. I have 7 siblings. I'm the 4th. First to graduate from high school, first to graduate from college. Got an engineering degree at an HBCU and went to work for Exxon as an engineer. And again, lots of people that helped, mentoring, took me under their wings. And I progressed through a 33-year career with Exxon, going from entry-level engineer to an executive leading global businesses. So that's the person that was riding down Magnolia Lane. But within that person that had progressed through all of that was the spirit of that six-year-old and the fascination and awe of being at a place as magical as Augusta National.
That leads me to so many questions, but I think the one at the top of my head is, where does that spirit to endure come from?
So my mother never played golf. And I probably could add to that, of course, she never played golf. But the idea of playing the ball as it lies is something she instilled in all 8 of her children. That you confront life as it actually is and then deal with it to achieve the things you want to achieve. You don't allow the circumstances to define you nor to define what's possible for you. And so that spirit of you set a goal. And my biggest first goal that I can remember is as a 5-year-old kid sitting in our shack trying to learn to read by the light of a kerosene lamp with smoke just sort of rising from the wick in the kerosene lamp, putting a black spot on the ceiling, warmed by the heat from our makeshift tin heater. So again, I'm trying to paint this picture of what life was like. But I'm sitting there and I set a goal to become the first person I know to graduate from high school. At that point, I didn't know anyone that had graduated from high school. And obviously, by the time I graduated 13 years later, I'd met people and seeing people graduate. But at the time, I set the goal. I didn't know anyone. And so that sense of dream big, don't let the obstacles get in the way. Figure out a way to deal with the obstacles. And rely upon your hard work and determination, the kindness and generosity of others, and there's always going to be some amount of luck thrown in there also.
Sure, sure. You always hear of golf as a metaphor for life, and I think people kind of think that's kind of kitschy and it's just thrown out there, but I think your story and the struggles endured throughout your upbringing really show that maybe even though you didn't have a connection with the game at an early age, it's like the game almost found you. It was kind of kismet. You lived by those rules that the same way that we play golf. And it's almost like it was fate that you were destined to find this game that had the same type of rules as the way that your mom taught you.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Dan, wholeheartedly. And that, I studied engineering, got an engineering degree, but I think that I was destined to be an engineer. I think I didn't know it, but I didn't know what an engineer was when I was born, but I think I was born an engineer. I used to take, we lived in this sawmill town and in the housing for the sawmill complex. And so we had a lot of junk wood around, and I would take that wood and I would build little cities in the dust using that wood. I'd build cars and trucks and buildings and dig out holes for a reservoir and run trenches for water to get to the city that I built. All those things. I didn't know that was civil engineering, but it was sort of innate. And I eventually found my way into engineering. I think golf is similar in that I agree with you 100% that it's a metaphor for life. There are a lot of similarities. And that's one of the things that attracts me to golf. And in golf, the feedback's a whole lot quicker than life in normal. You make decisions in life and it may take a while. In golf, the feedback is instant, but you face challenges. You deal with the elements, the conditions, the circumstances. But at the end of the day, you're trying to get the ball, as Robin Williams would say, from that tee to that hole way down yonder with a whole bunch of stuff in between. And it doesn't matter what the stuff in between is. You got to figure out how to get the ball to that tiny hole 400 yards away in as few strokes as possible. And you deal with everything along the way. That's life. That's life.
That's I couldn't put it better myself, nor would I try. I mean, it seems almost trivial to kind of steer this conversation towards golf and your journeys. But what was your first inkling that you might want to play golf? How does that enter into your life? Because I know with Exxon, you were so busy traveling. I mean, you got to the point where, and I'm assuming I'll probably get the title incorrect, but you were in charge of all of the Americas and making sure that people that needed fuel got fuel. I mean, that's a heady thing to deal with. And so where does golf kind of creep in? Where does it start to make its inroads into your life?
So I don't remember how old I was at the time, but I remember when I was a young kid, it would have been probably somewhere between when I was 10 and 12 years old.
Okay.
So we've moved from the backwoods into a little town. We're in a house now that has electricity. We have a television, which is a small little box with rabbit ears, which most people don't know what they are, but they were like antennas. There was no cable television back then.
Oh, I remember.
and I remember Jack Nicklaus, an interview with Jack Nicklaus. And he talked about working the ball. And first, I was fascinated by the idea of hitting this little white ball and just hitting it, period. This tiny ball. And the idea that you could make it go where you wanted it to go. That was fascinating to me on many levels. Just the physics of it, just the athleticism, the coordination required. So that's the first thing I remember about golf was that interview with Jack Nicklaus.
So prior to hearing Jack talk, had you had any physical experience with golf? Did you own clubs? Have you hit balls before?
No. I saw some guys hitting balls at the park. That's it. That's all I'd seen back then. So this is probably early 70s.
Okay.
When this is going on. And no, it hadn't seen a golf club in, you know, up close, or held a golf club or a golf ball or anything like that. So I'm working for Exxon. There are people that play golf. And, you know, it's something, as I said, that I'd been fascinated by before. But it just seemed so hard. And it was expensive. So I really didn't get into it. And then as I progressed through my career and was an executive, executive level, about to move from Virginia, where I was working at the time at our headquarters in Virginia, back to Texas. And the vice president for my division, over dinner, Eric and I were both at the dinner, says to me, "Jimmy, you're getting ready to go back to Texas. And it'll help you get along with the folks if you learn to start shooting something." And he said, "You can shoot animals or you can shoot par. You choose, you decide." So it may not have been exactly those words, but that was the essence of it.
Sure.
So my wife made the decision for me. She purchased a set of golf clubs for me, a set of Golden Bear Jack Nicklaus clubs, and she purchased some lessons. And so
smart woman.
She did. So I was going down to Texas on bachelor status because my wife was teaching at the time at the University of Virginia, the Darden School. So I was going to be commuting back and forth. So I had a lot of free time on my hand. But the first year, I was so busy in learning the organization, learning the people, dealing with sort of issues that came up in our operations, that I didn't get a chance to follow up. And then right before those lessons were about to expire, I went and signed up for the lessons. And initially, I couldn't even hit the ball. I played tennis. And in tennis, you're moving, the ball's moving, but it's a lot easier to hit it and you know where it's going. Golf, I couldn't even hit the ball.
Tennis is reactionary. And for most athletes, it's very, very difficult when that stupid little ball is standing still.
It's just sitting there. Sitting there staring at you. But then when I did connect to the ball, that feeling of achievement, of accomplishment, when I watched, it was under the lights at this place in Beaumont called Games People Play. And this PGA professional, Don, I don't remember Don's last name, but Don was teaching me, you know, the basics, how you grip the club, how you address the ball, and sort of the mechanics of the swing. And when I finally connected with that ball and watch it soar into the lights on that dark sky, in that dark sky, the sense of achievement and accomplishment, you'd think I had just discovered power or golf or lights or something. That sense that thrilled me. It was fascinating to me and gave me such a sense of achievement and accomplishment. And that's where it started. I was hooked. Late getting to golf, but when I got to it, I went after it with a passion.
Just full bore, 100%.
Full bore.
So how long had you been playing up until the time you decided to embark on this journey post-retirement?
Okay, so I started playing in 2005. So I've been playing 12 years.
Okay, all right. So at that point in time, are these courses even on your radar? The names of these courses, are they things that come up in daily conversations, or are they pipe dreams?
So they're not even pipe dreams. There are a handful of courses that we all know. We watch the Masters. You know, by now, I've watched Tiger Woods dominate golf. I've watched Phil Mickelson. I've watched other, you know, people come in, tall guys like me, Ernie Els, the Big Easy, Stuart Sink, these tall guys, because I'm 6'4".
Okay.
Most golfers that are successful are probably, you know, 5 feet to six feet tall. They're not, or even shorter. They're not tall guys. So I would watch some of these tall guys, but, so I'd heard of some of these courses, but I didn't dream of playing all of these courses. I'd only play roughly three or four at the time. The Ocean Course at Kiowa, which was the first course that notable course that I'd ever played. I played at the Country Club in Brookline, and I played Congressional, so I played three. Most of the courses on the list I'd never even heard of. So I didn't sit down and come up with this goal the way most avid golfers probably would have. For me, it was an idea that really sprang from something my wife did. She got me around, set me up for a round at Augusta National. And then after telling me about that, she gave me a book by this guy, John Sabino. He played the top 100 in the world, but it took him quite a while to do it. And so it was from that I said, you know, I'm getting ready to retire. I thought of reconnecting with the country, traveling to all 50 states, playing two rounds of golf in each state, one with strangers, one with people I know. And so it occurred to me, well, you already got the biggest one. If you're going to play 100 courses, why not just play the 100 best ones? I had no idea how difficult or challenging or impossible, virtually impossible, that would be. And so I didn't even know what the courses were until a couple of months later when the February issue of Golf Digest came out and it had the top 100 courses. And so I looked through that list. And there were courses I'd never heard of. Mayakamba, the Valley Club of Montecito, Milwaukee Country Club, Pikewood National. I'd never heard of these places. But I was going to have to figure out how to meet people and get invited to them all without asking.
People will rake me over the coals if I just leave that elephant in the room untouched. So I've got to circle back and ask you. Nonchalantly, which I love about your style, by the way, but nonchalantly, you said, my wife set me up for a round at Augusta National. So obviously, this being the white whale, right, that most people are kind of after, we've watched it every single year. People know the ins and outs of the course. Maybe people have been lucky enough to walk the grounds at a practice round or at the Women's Am or at the Masters themselves. But can you take us a little bit behind the scenes into that journey at Augusta National?
Okay. So obviously I got there. The first step, like people ask me, how do you get on Augusta National?
You don't
marry
ask.
Marry the white woman, the right woman first.
Right. But you never ask because someone's got to ask you.
That's right. The bottom line. That's right. So I am just so fortunate. I married way above my play grade. I mean, some people would say I really outkicked my coverage.
We'll make sure she hears this.
Yes, but fascinating, fascinating person, and not much gets in her way. When she sets her mind to something, she gets it done. And so she set her mind to getting me on Augusta National. So she did.
Love it.
But the sense of being there, I mentioned earlier, just in the van riding down Magnolia Lane, you turn in off of Washington Street, which has all of these bright neon signs and strip malls and
typical downtown
Right. Southern
city. Yep.
It, the idea that that such a magical place is adjacent to that street is probably mind-boggling in itself. Mm-hmm. But you're driving down, the canopy of trees over you, in front of you is that wraparound porch clubhouse that you see at the start of every Masters. And it's just, it's magical. It's surreal. You're there physically, but mentally not quite.
So you drove your own car. You drive
down. No, we actually flew a private plane. They picked us up at the airport in a van, and we're riding in this van down Magnolia Lane.
Gotcha.
They meet us at the front, take our clubs. We go into the clubhouse, go upstairs to the living quarters, change. And I write about this in the book and Playing from the Rough, just what it felt like. You see all of this history around you, these Masters champions looking down on you as you're tying your shoes, putting your shoes on, walking through the locker rooms, knowing that greatness has walked through those rooms and out into the practice facility where my caddy met me, a guy named Eddie from Washington, Georgia. Eddie and I connected. I practiced, you know, it was just sort of normal routine for practicing. And then we headed over to the par three course.
Is it busy on the range when you're warming up?
You know, it wasn't. And at this point, I have to be honest with you. You know, I could describe a lot of individual holes to you across the 100 courses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's starting to fade some now because, you know, it's been a few years.
Yeah, sure.
But the thing that I can't tell you much about is the Augusta practice range, because I was so out of my head. I mean, I was floating so far above the clouds that I was just tunnel vision that whole time. I was in
I think I'd be scared to take a divot at first, yes. Honestly.
Yes. So I was in a daze, and also you know, so I'll take you to the first tee. We play the par three course, work mm-hmm. our way around, have lunch, and of course I had to have pimento cheese sandwich.
Of course.
And then we're on the first tee. And my host and his family are something like royalty at Augusta National, I think. Mm. So there were a lot of people out around. A little gallery had formed around the tee. So you got all these people watching. And here I am. I'm thinking, I'm standing there over this little white ball, this little dimpled white dot sitting on a tee. And the last thing I want to do is embarrass my host.
Sure.
And so that's that fear is there. And I'm thinking that 6-year-old me is thinking back to, how did I get here? How did this guy playing baseball with a stick in a doll's head and dusty roads get to the place like this? And I'm just, okay, I got to put myself together and I got to swing. And hopefully it's not too crisp, but my ball landed in the fairway, just a little left of where Danny, a little short of where Danny Yates, my host, had hit his ball. In the sense of relief, sure. my butt, this is the crisp part, my butt cheeks just relaxed. Yes. And then I'm thinking, I get to my ball and I'm thinking, wow, I'm in the fairway. You know, Tiger misses this fairway and I'm in it. But
all the time he misses it.
But I'm still on the cloud. My feet haven't touched the ground yet. So, you know, I'm trying to just calm my nerves. And I talk to my caddy. He gives me my club, and I hit a good shot. It hits on the front right corner of the green, and then trickles off the green and rolls away. Now, but I'm still thinking, I'm going to get a par. This is easy. I got a good short game. The pin's at the back left. I chip on, and I'm thinking, I didn't get it close enough, so I'm probably going to get a bogey with a two-putt. I'll sum up my whole round for you by telling you, across those 18 holes, I had more putts than I had swings. That's how tough those greens are. So I three-putted, chipped on and three-putted, ended up with a double bogey. Then my first par didn't come until, I guess it's Flowering Crab Apple, the fourth hole.
Okay.
Par three. Hit a nice high soaring six iron that cleared the bunker, plopped onto the green, and I almost birdied, but it stopped a little short of the hole. Danny said, pick it up. And there I had my first par.
Beautiful.
But I had to really collect myself. Those first three holes were just so surreal and unreal. You're not even worried about golf. You're worried about not embarrassing yourself.
Sure. I'm sure your head's spinning.
And finally I said, I got to calm down. It's just golf. It's just golf. And so it was an amazing day. The time passed so quickly. Amen Corner. That's what I really had dreamed about playing. You know, you talked about courses. Now that's one I had dreamed of because of the Masters, being able to one day play Amen Corner. And so playing Amen Corner was fun. My caddy and I had a little discussion on, so first I'll back up. Number 11, great drive, missed the green by a few inches. Chipped, stubbed my ball, sort of clipped the pristine Augusta National turf before hitting the ball. So I left the ball 6 feet short of the cup. It felt like 100 feet.
Of course.
And I two-putted from there for a bogey. Get to number 12. The thing about 12 is the green is only 10 yards deep.
It's so thin, and that bunker is so big up there.
The bunkers loom large.
Yes.
And so you have the bunkers in the front, the bunkers in the back, and you have Race Creek. So my caddy says to me, it's 150 yards to the pin. You if you're 10 yards short, you're in the water of the bunker. 10 yards long, you're in the bunker. So you got a club right. That's the challenge. You really got a club right. And so he says to me, a six iron. I said, I think a seven would do. And then he does what caddies do when they're trying to get you to hit more club. I think he said, there's a slight breeze. It's not really downhill. And so he convinces me to hit the six. I hit the best six iron I'd ever hit. The ball soared high, straight over the flag, plopped right into the bunker behind the green.
An intimidating shot. Then the front bunker, then Race Creek after.
It's an intimidating shot. So I said, I'm not going to take that risk. I'm going to hit out to what would be from the back of the bunker, the front right part of the green. So from the tee box, it would be the left part of the green.
Sure, the fat portion of it.
Right. So I'm chipping. So when the ball rolls off the green, which it will, it's going to roll. It's not going to roll into the creek. It's going to roll into some rough, which it did. So I chipped up to 3 feet, and then I missed my putt. So I double bogey there. Get the 13, hit a great drive. Eddie says to me, so how much do you want to leave for your next shot? I said, a putt. And he goes, no, you should really lay up. And I'm like, I may never, you know, think about, you know, so when you're on the course too, you're thinking about all these rounds you've seen on television. So I'm looking over at the pine trees and I'm thinking about Phil hitting that miraculous shot from behind those trees. And I'm like, if he could hit from the pine straw behind the trees, it's nothing in front of me. I should be able to get, take my 3 wood, put it on the green, and I'm at Augusta. I'm going to get an eagle on this hole. So much to Eddie's chagrin, I hit my 3 wood. And it careened off to the right. Fortunately for me, there's this space, this confluence of the 14th fairway and the 13th fairway. And that's where my ball ended up. So I'm 60 yards away, not 60 yards just from the front of the green if you were straight away, but where the pin was and how far right I was. So I'm 60 yards away, hit like a little 3/4 60 degree wedge, and I got a 10-foot putt for birdie. So Eddie says, we're going to get you a birdie here. We got to get you a birdie here. Let's take our time. You know, he cleans the ball. He's trying to calm me down and get my nerves in check. And I left it short. I left it on the lip. So anyway, that was it. That was, and then, you know, we played the rest of the rounds again. It was fine from then on until the 18th hole. I hit a bad drive, but it was amazing. Just amazing day. And you're thinking about all the golf history and all the Sunday pin positions. 16 was the Sunday pin position. And you're just remembering all of those things. It's just a magical, special place. So
what was the post-round kind of hang like there? I know there's some of the courses you played, you know, it was almost difficult for you to get off the course. People would, you know, just want to talk to you and hang out on the back patio. What's Augusta like after the round is done?
So for me, Augusta, I actually had to get back to Atlanta and head back to Houston and get back to I hadn't yet retired. I still had a couple of weeks of work. So the other guys were staying there. And so
right in the cabins on ground.
Yeah, they were staying on property. I had to get back to work. So I actually, after the round, Danny and I went over to the actual Augusta National Pro Shop.
Right, ANGC, not the Masters one.
Not the Masters, the ANGC Pro Shop. And I purchased some souvenirs for me and a sweater, a shirt for my wife. I got a run at Augusta. She got a shirt. And then I actually headed back to the plane and flew back to Atlanta. So I didn't hang much at Augusta. The hang was more the lunch at lunchtime in the clubhouse dining room having lunch, but everybody is sort of in their groups. There because it's a place you bring your game to, I guess. And so you're bringing people and people are interacting with each other. But just, you know, I'm actually amazed I remember anything because it's just magical in your head, in your mind, when you're there. It's just, you have to suspend belief.
Sure.
You know, and again, to come from where I came from, to be standing at Augusta National, to be playing Augusta National. I mean, it would be amazing. Like the first time, that was my second time at Augusta National. I'd gone for Masters for the final round of the Masters the year earlier. And so I'd been there, but it's different. Now you're there playing.
Yes, you're inside the ropes.
Yes.
Because it's about you.
And
right? When you're at the Masters, it's about them, but now it's about you.
Yes, and again, it's a world that I learned to navigate, but not my world.
That's an important point. So I've got a bunch of other questions, but let's jump to that. How is that, knowing your upbringing, where you came from, what a down to earth person you are, to be in I mean, for lack of a better word, in some points, a secret society, you know, of top tier golfers, courses that really aren't talked about. You know, you mentioned some of those ones that you've played. No one has heard of those because those courses don't want to be spoken about in the same breath as the Kiowas or the country clubs or Augusta or Cypress or Pebble, right? They want to be low-key. They don't want people to know their members. They want to be a complete refuge. How was that navigating kind of that circle of people?
So first of all, I have to just keep in mind the things my mother taught us about being respectful of other people. And it never left me that I was being invited in to someone's home, and that you would treat it the same way as being invited into someone's home. You're obviously grateful and you got to be respectful, but it puts you also on pins and needles. It's a very small world. Once you enter into that world, yes. It's a really small world. And so the slightest of mistakes or faux pas or errors could have doomed my quest.
Sure.
Because word would probably spread very quickly. This isn't the type of guy you'd want to have, you want to bring to your place. Fortunately for me, that never happened. I really just naturally, with all the things my mother taught all of her kids, you know, just be respectful of other people. And even if you don't know all the etiquette and the rules, which there are a lot, but if you don't know those, just being respectful and grateful and understanding and never taking for granted someone else's generosity, that's the thing that you have to keep in, just keep grounded, stay grounded in that.
But and I think there's nothing wrong with asking either.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just, but you know, I was nervous a lot and just trying always to be very mindful not to do anything that could be interpreted as being disrespectful, because that would never be my intent, but I didn't want to accidentally do it either. So that part, there was sort of that stress each time. And that sort of, you know, in golf, tension is the enemy of a fluid swing.
Mm.
And so at some point, you know, in order to play, you really have to be able to relax. But that was always with me. I always really tried to be mindful, to be respectful. But playing, I mean, these courses, you know, whether it's A-Man Corner at Augusta National, whether it's the Cypress Point by itself, or the 16th hole at Cypress Point, or whether, you know, it's playing the 6th hole at Pebble Beach, which is a public course, but talk about scary. I think that second shot on the 6th hole, looking, especially since there are bunkers on the left and you got to get out to the right. And so you're likely to be going over the ocean to get back to the fairway, up the hill to what looks like a micro dot. That's a scary shot. So you need to be relaxed to be able to make those swings. But there are just some iconic holes, iconic clubs and places that it was fascinating to be there. And again, I was in awe. I was in awe. Now, I do have to state that there's only so many ways you can arrange grass, trees, sand, and water. So there were a few courses that sort of lost, the splendor was lost. But for the most part, every one of these courses, I was just in awe. And playing them, being there. And then the people were just so kind and generous and open, and And, you know, you mentioned some of the places like Old Sandwich. I spent more time hanging in the clubhouse at Old Sandwich with Jay Wick, who's the head pro, with his folks and some of the members, and Andy Neer, who's the president there, just hanging out with those guys. My host eventually had to leave, and they said, go ahead, we got him. And so I spent more time in the clubhouse afterwards than I did on the course.
I think it's important for listeners to understand that this was not a free endeavor as well. This did come at some financial cost. I just want to read off, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is from Golf Digest, just so people know I didn't pull this out of thin air. But we've got approximately $25,000 in guest fees, approximately $15,000 in meals, and $10,000 in caddy, and then obviously, which this to me struck me as low, only $5,000 in merchandise. Jimmy, I got to tell you what, the first time I went to the Masters, I think I spent close to that. And every time since, my wife has said, now listen, when you go, realize there's only 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year. You can't wear a Masters shirt every day. You can't wear a Masters pullover a day. So you don't need five or six of them. I don't want people to think that, oh, people are just giving him, you know, rounds of golf at these places. You paid guest fees, and guest fees are not that cheap at some of these courses.
No. So a couple of things. One, in terms of merch. So I'm really not a big merch guy. And growing up in poverty, the things, like, this is going to sound counterintuitive and sort of conflicting, because I think I spent an actual dollars, probably $60,000. It would cost, back then, it would have cost a little over 100 total. But I had so many frequent flyer miles, so that $15,000 was for hotels and rental cars and meals, so those types of expenses. I saved a lot. Probably about $40,000 on rental cars, hotels, and airline trips, because it's a lot of miles. I flew over 70,000 miles, drove over 17,000 miles. So it's a lot. But having those loyalty points probably saved me about $40,000.
That's right.
And so I purchased two things at each club. A cap and a coin size ball mark. So that was 98 caps, 98 coin size ball marks. So I'll ask you a question. Why wasn't it 100?
I'm going to assume that there was possibly two courses that didn't have them as there merch.
There were two courses.
Or maybe you weren't allowed to purchase.
No, two private clubs that have two top 100 courses and one logo.
Baltusrol.
And Wingfoot.
There you go. East and West. Yes. Okay. Yes. There you go. That's a great trivia question. You got me on that. Good. That's good.
So it was quite expensive to do. And today, so 5 years ago, that's how much it was. Today, it would probably be $150,000 at least.
Sure. And now I want to ask you about the logistics, because I think what people don't realize is that is playing an average of about every 3.5 days. So it's playing about every 3.5 days on average to get all those rounds in a year. Now, yeah, I know you played Augusta before the June start date, correct?
Right.
Okay, so you had 99 courses in those 365 days, but still, I mean, the numbers still apply. So what were the logistics like? Was everything planned out, or did you just kind of fly by the seat of your pants at times?
You cannot plan everything out. It just doesn't work. There are too many variables. There's weather. There are airline delays, cancellations. There are hosts who have conflicts, who end up with a conflict. There are just so many things that can interfere with you being able to execute a plan. So you have to be nimble and you have to be ready to go when you get the call. Mm-hmm. Like I played Oakmont. When I played Oakmont, I got a call from one of the guys I'd played with that was in our foursome at Augusta. That Monday, that next week, that following week, Monday through Thursday, actually, I was scheduled to go out to Colorado, play three courses in Colorado and Nebraska, and then get back home Thursday night, back home on Friday. And I had a commitment with my son on Saturday. I get a call Thursday night, the week before, Jimmy, can you play at Oakmont on Sunday and Monday? When you get those calls for courses like Oakmont, Seminole, Augusta National, Chicago Golf Club, Shinnecock, those places, the answer is always the same.
Always.
No matter what's going on in your life, the answer is an immediate yes.
I love that.
Then you figure out how to deal with the consequences.
Yes.
After you say yes.
Yes.
And so,
you know, let me break in real quick. You know, I tell my friends every once in a while, because I have some decent connections, which I cherish in this game. And I say, if I ever ask you to accompany me somewhere, don't worry about where we're going. Don't worry about anything. Just tell me you'll say yes. So I love that there's someone else, another kindred spirit out there that understands what that's like.
It's yes. And then you figure out. And for me, it was, how do I get back to, I need to rearrange my schedule for the next week. And then I got to figure out how to get back to Atlanta from Mullen, Nebraska.
Sandhills.
But yep, that was a Thursday course that became a Friday course. And the closest airport is 5 hours away, Denver International. And so my mission at every course, you know, I really tried to be in the moment. At Sandhills, it was check the box.
Sure.
I need to play this course as fast as possible, jump in the car and speed to the airport. I probably set a land speed record between Mullen and Denver International Airport. As a matter of fact, I came in hot and I called a rental car company and I said, I'm coming in hot. I'm not going to have a chance to return the rental car and still make my flight. I need someone to meet me at the terminal. And they said, we got you, Mr. James. And sure enough, I get to the terminal. I jump out of the car, you know, grab my, I jump out of the, cause I wouldn't have time to check them.
Sure.
So I jumped out of the car, grabbed my luggage, ran in and barely made the flight. But I had a commitment to my son that I had to keep. And so I'm sure you know that.
I understand completely.
You,
yes, sir.
And so, but those types of things come up. There were hurricanes. There were mudslides. There was a power outage at the busiest airport in the world, the Atlanta Airport. Yeah, there were wildfires. My Acumba almost burned down.
Huh.
There was a storm that swept through and took out the iconic tree at Crooked Stick. There were all sorts of things that came up that would affect the schedule that had to be worked through and overcome in order to get this done in that short time frame. It seems like, you know, one course every 3.5 days. If it had that type of cadence and rhythm, that would be great, but it wasn't. I went right. Stretches. There were weeks. There were times I didn't play a course. I didn't play during a 2 week, 2.5 week period. And so I played, there were times I played two courses in a day also, like, but there were four courses at Bandon that are all in the top 100. I played back to back 36 holes, finished up at 7 o'clock, drove up to Seattle, got in around 1 in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, got up the next morning and went to Sahali to play Sahali. and then caught a flight from Seattle to Houston. Wow. It was, and the last, we don't have time for it now, but the last, I got down to the end. I think I had 34 days and 29 courses. And the courses were stretched across the country as far west as Idaho and up to New York, South Carolina, North Carolina.
Wow.
And New Jersey, Pennsylvania, all of those. In that last month, I kissed the wife, hugged the kids, and said, at some point I'll be home, but I have no idea when.
Well, I want to get you out of here with just some rapid fire questions, and then let's talk the book and how people can read about this amazing journey, because this, trust me, people, this is just a teaser right here. This is just to whet the appetite. Jimmy, what course surprised you the most?
In terms of splendor, or
let's just go a course,
maybe Pipeline National. Never heard of it. Built by two guys that had never designed a golf course before. Just the views, the vistas, the fairways cut through the trees atop this mesa with limestone deposits. And the greens are like infinity pools that fall off into the Shenandoah Valley. And the challenge of it, narrow fairways, six-inch Kentucky bluegrass rough. There's no first or second cut. There are no collars around the green. You miss the green by an inch, you're chipping from six-inch rough. Yeah. But the splendor of the place just blew me away.
Course that you, if only given one course the rest of your life to play, could return to day after day.
You know, so that's a different question. I'm going to answer two questions. Okay. If I only had one course to play, it was my last round of golf. I thought it would have been Cypress Point because it's got everything.
Sure.
But
that's my dream course. That's it. Not Augusta, not any, it's Cypress.
It is special. It's got everything. But I came down to Pine Valley,
okay,
because of the challenge.
Mm.
It is a challenging place. And I just go down fighting. Give me the hardest, the toughest, the meanest, and that's where I play my last round of golf. Now, for every day, there are a few places, but I'd say one of the most underrated, I think, is Somerset Hills.
Okay.
And I think the second hole at Somerset Hills, which is a par three, Redan. When I first played it, I had no idea what a Redan was. I didn't know what template holes were. When I went to Bandon and played at Old MacDonald, and I know this is embarrassing to say, but I always try to keep it real. I thought Old MacDonald was the silliest golf course I'd ever played, with this giant greens and crooked layout and all that stuff. It was only because I didn't understand template holes. When I played Somerset Hills, I was so fascinated by the challenge of that third hole. I did some research there, and it was not Somerset Hills. I didn't know it's Somerset Hills, but Yeaman Hall. I did some research. I was so fascinated. And it was Seth Rayner, which led me to C.B. MacDonald, which then led me to the history of his travels in the British Isles and the understanding of the holes he found that he thought were great, would be great for avid golfers, amateurs, and experts alike. And he built courses like National Golf Links with these template holes. Once I understood that, my appreciation for template holes in those types of courses just exploded. I mean, I love Seth Rayner, C.B. MacDonald designs. And I think in this country, the most fun golf course to play is National Golf Links.
Okay.
But yeah, that that's so, but Somerset Hills, to answer your rapid fire question directly.
Someone gives you a lawn chair. They said, Jimmy, you're going to live out the rest of your days sitting at this hole, overlooking people hitting shots here. What hole is that?
Ooh, that's a tough one, because just so many beautiful holes. Possibly Pikewood, possibly some of the holes at Gaza Ranch on Lake Coeur d'Alene, Friar's Head. When you come off the 14th green and head to the 15th tee box, and you've got that view of the Sound behind 15, and then you walk across this bridge that's hanging off a cliff that falls into the Sound. I mean, it's that one's hard, Dan. There's just so many spectacular views that one's hard. But I would tell you, on my computer screen as a screensaver, I have the third hole at Pikewood National.
Okay. Well, there you go then. There you go. All right. One more. Two more. Sorry. First off, which pro shop did you enjoy the most? Granted, you got hat and ball marker from all of them, but what pro shop were you just kind of blown away by? Maybe in its simplicity or maybe in its grandeur?
Pebble Beach.
Hmm.
Because of all the stuff at Pebble Beach, which again is another great hole. I mean, 18, number six, number seven, the par three. You could sit there. So another one I'd probably like to sit out on and watch a lot is 18 at Pebble Beach or seven at Pebble Beach. But Pebble Beach is pro shop, because for a engineer's mind like mine, it had some of everything.
Mm.
It was massive. And it just had history. It had novelty. It had just great merchandise in general. It was a potpourri of everything golf you could think of, to me, was there at the Pebble Beach Links Golf Shop.
I don't want you to have to single one person out, but who's the most interesting person that you met, new person that you met along this journey, or one of the most interesting people?
So let me give you actually, I'm going to give you three answers to that.
Sure.
One of the obvious, Jimmy Dunn.
Sure.
I played with Jimmy at Shinnecock. He's in Playing from the Rough. I start out that chapter with Jimmy in it saying, Jimmy Dunn is a diminutive giant. Little guy with a big, big, big heart. The guy is special. Just oozes compassion and concern and care and leadership and no nonsense.
Mm.
Very fascinating to just talk with him. My caddy at Acadia Bluff, David Enderby. Caddied on the pro tour, caddied in rounds with Jack Nicklaus, and he didn't caddy for Jack Nicklaus, but he was caddying for someone in paired with Jack, and also Arnold Palmer. But just listening to his stories, from his caddy stories, and the way he calmed, I had one of my best rounds, because his ability to get me to just relax and swing. And then he got his childhood friend to get me onto Oakland Hills. And then someone off the golf course, two people off the golf course, Nathan. So at the end, and I get a little emotional thinking about it, but at the end, when all the pressure was on me and I'm trying to get these last courses done, I'm dragging my travel bag behind me, my rollerboard, and through the rental car, national rental car, across from LaGuardia Airport. And this agent there comes up to me, this guy comes up to me and he says, "You a golfer?" And I said, "Recreationally." He says, "Well," and I told him, I said, "Yeah, I'm playing the top 100 courses and I'm down to my last 30, and I got to get them done within the next month. And he seemed unfazed by all that. And he goes, well, I hold a record at a golf course. I hold the course record at a golf course in Hawaii. And I'm like, wow, I'm impressed. It's what's going through my mind. He goes, yeah, nobody has ever shot as high as the 142 that I shot at that course. And the pressure relief, just the smile that Nathan brought to me, just a special guy. I think he sensed all the pressure I was feeling. And it was a lot of pressure. I had committed to people. People had helped me. And I'm getting down to the end. And is this going to really happen? And can I do it? And just that little relief valve, that levity of the situation. And I just laughed fully and loud and hugged Nathan and thanked him. And then there's this guy. I played Victoria National, and I'm driving up to Columbus, Ohio, just north of Columbus, to play the next day at Double Eagle. And I'm in this big, massive rental car, this Affinity QX80. It's a drizzly night. It's 10 o'clock, and the indicator light for low air pressure in one of the tires comes on. Pull over, air is oozing out of the back driver's side tire. I'm not, all these 18-wheelers passing by, I'm not on a cold, drizzly night getting out, changing a tire on a truck that big. So I call the roadside service. This guy gets there, and he starts to back up to the car before I can get out. He's backing up, letting the bed down like he's going to tow the vehicle. I get out of the car. I go over to him and said, you know, I'm Jimmy. Introduce myself. I said, I don't need a tow. I need a tire change. And this guy just gets sort of angry. And, you know, I'm trying to relieve the situation, understand what's going on. And he starts storming around and gets his lug wrench and all this stuff. Finally, I just ask him, what gives? And he says, I just drove 50 miles for $10. And I'm thinking, what? So what do you get if it would have been a tow? I get $20. So that moment, Dan, on this dark night along the road, this interstate in Indiana, you have this black guy, me, traveling across the country, spending tens of thousands of dollars chasing this frivolous dream. And you have this white guy, George, and is his name, that's worried about the difference between a difference of $10, because that matters greatly in his life.
Puts things in perspective.
And it puts it in perspective. That's when that six-year-old part of me is coming out and is thinking, and I just say to him, don't worry about what you're getting paid by them. The tip will more than make up for it. But that moment to think about, again, it just took me back to, you have two challenges, really big challenges in the country in terms of, there were the race issues, and then there were the poverty issues. And at that night, on that night, on that dark road, these two lives, my life and George's life, came together. And it's like, we are in this together. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to be as a country. No matter the differences between us, no matter our individual journeys, we are all in this together. And we got to be able to rely upon each other and help each other. That's why when you ask me about interesting people, I can't leave George out.
Beautiful. Honestly, it's beautiful. And I'm not sure that this podcast could have ended on a better note. I do want you, though, to plug the book and let people know where to buy it so they can get deeper into this story.
So the book is Playing from the Rough by Jimmy James. It will be on bookshelves on June 11th, but you can get yours early by ordering it. Pre-ordering it from Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org. Order the book. It's a remarkable, I think, memoir that braids together my life's journey and my golf journey, and really talks about the power of perseverance, determination, overcoming challenges, and the unifying power of golf, which under the common passion for golf, differences just melt away.
Jimmy, I knew going into this would be a long, kind of sprawling podcast. You did not disappoint. I cannot thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Dan. Really appreciate it. I'm glad we got to see each other face to face, and say hi to the boys for me.
I will. Thank you, sir. All right, people. So either get busy golfing or get busy dying.
Absolutely. It depends on the COR of the flagstick, so the coefficient of restitution flagstick. In U.S. Opens, I'll take it out, and every other tour event when it's fiberglass, I'll leave it in and bounce that ball against the flagstick if I need to.
Hey, podcast patrons. Real quick break in the episode here. I want to talk to you about Big Wings Golf Apparel. They've just become the official glove and proud sponsor of us, Leave the Pin Podcast. We all know how important a comfortable glove and good grip are for the golf swing. And like us, you're probably tired of overpaying for gloves at the pro shop right before your round of golf, or getting some crap glove that's overpriced at Golf Galaxy, or pulling something out of your bag that's stiff as a board because it's you sweated through it and you left it in there for 2 weeks before you played again. Well, thankfully, Big Wings Golf Apparel has the solution. Go visit bigwingsgolf.com before your next round for all your golf glove and apparel needs. Experience unmatched comfort and a perfect grip with these premium Cabretta leather gloves and feel the difference with every swing. Big Wings Golf Apparel, where craftsmanship meets performance. Again, that's bigwingsgolf.com, and you, our listeners, can use code LTP for 10% off your first order. Now, back to the regularly scheduled podcast. Swannies is here with a fresh take. Performance-based materials are a given these days, but if you're looking for the stretchiest and most lightweight pieces that deliver a look that says I'm here for a good time, take a walk on the Swannies side. With fabric sourced from recycled plastics and design sourced from our very own weekend warriors, Swannies is looking out for both our planet and those that need a little style to boost their drive another 15 yards. Premium looks from top to bottom at swannies.com.